20852.
It's time for Fed Talk, the live show for feds in the know. From federal agencies to Capitol Hill, the attorneys of Shaw, Bransford, and Roth bring in experts from across the federal community to bring you inside the issues. Fed Talk is meant to provide general information about legal issues. However, the views expressed in this program are not intended to provide legal counseling. Listeners are cautioned not to rely upon any statements made in resolving legal issues they may face, but instead to consult with their own attorney about specific situations. Attorneys are not engaged in providing legal services while appearing on the program and are not responsible in any manner for the consequences that may stem directly or indirectly from reliance on any statement made during this program.
Good morning and welcome to Fed Talk. I'm Deborah Roth. Welcome to our retirement benefits show. And of course, talking federal employee retirement benefits in today's world means only whether it's going to get cut, or I think that's almost inevitable, when it's going to get cut, how's it going to get cut. And I know the announcement to our show says we bring in the experts, but today we really do. And first and foremost, I'm so fortunate to have with us on our radio show Mike Causey, who 15 years ago gave us our start on Fed Talk. So,
good deal. Delighted to be here.
Welcome, Mike.
Who knew it would last?
Huh? Right. In fact, when I heard Mike was going to be my guest, I'm like, well, why am I even showing up? But we're really, really glad to have Mike here. I think everybody inside and outside or right around the Beltway, if you think federal employee benefits, Mike is the guru. He is the know-it-all. He has really always such interesting insights. We also have with us one of our regulars. Dan's with us almost every year. Dan is, it's Dan Adcock, and he's the legislative director for NARF. So if you're talking federal employee retirement benefits, you get Dan Adcock. So we're really, really excited to have Dan with us again. Thank you, Dan, for being here.
Sure. Thanks, Deborah.
And we also have with us someone who's going to give us a perspective, because that's sort of the talk in town, is, well, are federal employee retirement benefits, are they in line with the private sector? And that seems to be a very big focal point of the conversation of how to rearrange them, otherwise known as cut them. And so we have Lenny Santacola with us. Lenny's joining us by phone. Lenny's with World at Work. Lenny?
Hi, Deborah. Glad to be here.
Thank you, Lenny. Thank you for joining us. And, you know, for our listeners, I know who World at Work is. I am sure most of our listeners do not. Tell us a little bit about who is World at Work, what do you all do, and what's your role there?
Oh, thanks, Deborah. Well, World at Work is a not-for-profit professional membership association. We're based here in Scottsdale, Arizona, but we do have an office there in Washington, D.C. And primarily, we provide certification, education, and resources on global total rewards issues that help organizations attract, motivate, and retain their workforce.
Which is certainly one of the things we've been hearing as an issue for federal employment for years, certainly not just through this recession. And Lenny, what's your role there at World at Work?
At World at Work, as a benefits practice leader, I primarily get a chance to work on products, educational products, and informational resources in the benefits arena and in employee benefits and other total rewards areas. And those products and resources help our members and customers do their job.
And so, Lenny, what we're going to do is we're going to talk a little bit about what is, just as our baseline, what does the federal employee retirement benefit look like today? And I'm hoping that Dan and Mike can walk us through it in the most simplified way. And then, Lenny, what I want to do is get you to tell us the comparison to, because you read all about it, and certainly the people on the Hill are saying that that benefit is out of line with the private sector, and it'd be really interesting to hear your perspective on that.
Okay.
So, Dan and Mike, who wants to go first? We all know CSRS. Very few people are left employed today in the government who are eligible to get the full CSRS benefit.
Talking to the Federal Times guys this week, and they said that 4 out of 5 people who are currently on the job are in the FERS system. So CSRS is it's an iceberg that's melting in the sun, you know, disappearing like the World War II generation.
Except that Dan's entire, and probably his entire constituency, or almost, at NARF, is in CSRS.
Well, a big part of it is, but obviously we have a growing number of federal employee retirement system retirees entering the roles, and I think by the time we get to about, 2024, there's parity between civil service retirement system and federal employee retirement system retirees. So they're a minority, but they're a fastly growing minority.
Well, and you may be getting a lot more coming in as members too, the way things are going now.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, that's the concern. A lot of these proposals are going to
flood the system.
I mean, especially with the article that was in the Washington Post today about the number of retirees who are eligible to the number of employees that are eligible to retire, and with all these proposals that are coming out that are very demoralizing to the federal workforce, you know, people retire when they can afford to retire, and if they're in that position and they don't want to take any more of this heat, then they're out the door, which we're really concerned is going to make the brain drain in the federal government of losing our most senior people even worse.
The Post numbers said that there are 550,000 who could leave today. 550,000, and that typically,
and that's out of 1.92 million employees.
Yeah, right.
That's 25%.
Right. It doesn't count the Postal Service.
Right.
But and the
that's
government
25%
last
of the workforce.
Year had but there again, this is where the brain drain came into being, because in 1999 somebody looked at these very same numbers and said, "Aha, we're going to lose them all." Well, it didn't happen. The retirement tsunami has not happened.
But it didn't happen. It didn't happen because no one was saying, "I'm going to go to high five,"
right,
as opposed to high
but
three.
It didn't happen. But it didn't happen for 11, 12 years. You know, I mean, someday it'll happen. But I mean, it's a good media event, and this may change things. But look, if unemployment remains high.
Yeah.
If there's nowhere to go, federal workers typically retire, I think, 2 years earlier than people in the private sector. And many of them retire to take second jobs. Well, in this day and age of Homeland Security and defense and whatnot, a lot of people are leaving government and going with a contractor.
Right.
They have great skills. They have great contacts. And they have that top secret security clearance, which is worth a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
But for the average federal worker, it's not like just going out and getting another job, unless you really want to downsize yourself and go into Walmart.
So CSRS truly is the Cadillac of all plans. I mean, no one can dispute that. What is the difference between CSRS and FERS as it stands today?
Well, can I tell you, Dan would know much more than I could, but I tell you what happened at the time. The Government Accountability Office, then the GAO, did a study, and they said that less than 30% of the people who join the government, that is, you walk in, swear the oath, sign up, less than 30% retired from the government. So they said, well, let's come up with a cheaper system and one that's portable. And that's where FERS came in. You got a Social Security component. You've got a very generous 401k plan with a 5% match and a modest but civil service benefit that's partially indexed inflation. So for most people coming into government at any time, FERS is a better deal because you can take it with you. When you will leave and you can take it with you. But if you're a lifer, CSRS is the Cadillac.
Right. And I've always heard, Dan, that CSRS was kind of like the albatross they wore around their neck, because you couldn't leave, you couldn't take it with you, and it kind of created its own demoralizing.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, I think sometimes this kind of defined benefit retirement program is sometimes called the golden handcuffs. But I do want to put the civil service retirement system annuity into perspective. I guess I would not call it the gold standard as far as what a retirement program is, because you have to go back to the creation of the civil service retirement system, in that when Social Security was first created in 1935, there was a conscious decision by the Congress not to provide or not to have federal government employees participate in Social Security. And so what the totality of that civil service retirement system annuity equals the equivalent of a Social Security benefit plus what the equivalent of a private sector pension was. And for the time when that program was born, when FERS was created in the mid-80s, that was basically how retirement programs were done in this country. And obviously, at the time that FERS was created, we've seen an evolution away from defined benefit annuity retirement to defined contribution retirement savings through 401ks in the private sector, and now with the respect to FERS, the Thrift Savings Plan.
Yeah. Lenny, what's your take on what Dan has to say about that comparison?
Well, I would agree with Dan. I mean, there's a lot of comparison. The FERS has, three pieces. You have the defined benefit annuity piece, you have the Social Security piece, and then you have the their saving piece, which is, you know, comparable to the 401k. Certainly in the private sector, just comparing the FERS annuity defined benefit piece to the corporate private sector, that has been going away for the last couple of decades. So more and more corporations are not offering defined benefit retirement plans and are evolving more into a defined contribution approach. And part of that, I know one of you mentioned about the CRS plan being the Cadillac.
I did.
If you're a lifer, well, you know, and in the government, you do have a lot of people that stay for their entire careers. And what we found in the private sector, that's no longer the case. You know, my parents and grandparents' generation, you know, they would get out of college or whatever, and they go to work for somebody, and they'd be there for 40 years. And we don't see that anymore in the private sector. And that's one of the reasons why there's been an evolution away from defined benefit programs, because employees are not staying their entire career with one employer.
So listen, Lenny, we got to take a break because I do want to talk to you more about these distinctions. We do need to take our first commercial break. You're listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Hello, my federal friends. It's the Geico Gecko, and I've got good news for you. I might even say it's some of the best news ever. Okay, well, definitely in the top three. The big news. Geico now offers discounts for most federal employees GS7 or above, which is no doubt a lot of you out there. So you could be saving hundreds of dollars on your car insurance, all with a company that began over 70 years ago with the sole purpose of serving government employees like yourself. Yeah, that's right. Geico, the government employees insurance company. And today, well, we're the third largest car insurance company in the nation. And did you know about Geico's 97% customer satisfaction rate? Well, saving money tends to make people rather happy, I think. So congrats again to those federal employees GS7 or above. Welcome to the Savings Club. Mike?
Got it. Hey, folks, this is Mike Causey. The Gecko's right. Discounts are available for most federal employees GS7, the equivalent or above. Just call Geico at 1-800-947-AUTO, go to geico.com, or visit your local Geico office to see how much you could save.
Welcome back to Fed Talk. I'm Deborah Roth. This is your federal retirement benefits program, where we talk about the potential cuts or changes in your federal retirement benefits. If you have a question or a comment for any one of our guests, we have Mike Causey with us. We have Dan Adcock, who's from NARF. We have Lenny Santacola, who's from World at Work. Feel free to give us a call. We're toll free, 1-877-936-9333, or you can just shoot us an email. Our email address is fedtalk@federalnewsradio.com. Lenny, are you still with us?
Yes, I am.
Okay, so Lenny, you were talking about the three pieces to the federal employee FERS program and how one of those pieces has come out. Tell us a little bit generally, you're starting to come out in the private sector. I think you said that's been going on for decades. There's been a decrease in private sector employers offering that piece of the retirement plan.
Yes, and primarily...
That's a long time, decades.
Oh, yeah. I mean, in 1978 was when the 401k provision sort of came into existence. And again, that really became about as a supplement to defined benefit plans. But as the workforce demographics have changed, as I said earlier, where we don't have people staying their entire career with one employer, more and more employers have moved to the defined contribution, and specifically 401k as being the most prevalent of mm-hmm. those options, as being the primary retirement vehicle for individuals. In fact, I saw a survey recently by Towers Watson that said they've been following the Fortune 100 for many years, and there's about only 17 employers still today in the Fortune 100 that offer only a traditional defined benefit approach. So clearly, defined contribution has taken over as the primary retirement approach.
Well, so I'm curious, Lenny, you must be watching. In fact, I know you're watching some of the proposals that are being talked about. Some of them are like secret behind door discussions between the vice president and members on the Hill at the Blair House. They're being reported about potential changes to the Federal Employee Retirement Benefit Program. What's your take on that? Because what certain members of Congress are saying is we're just trying to get them in line with the private sector.
Well, a couple of things. First of all, we do have a public policy group in Washington, D.C. that monitors that. So I'm not as close to the legislative proposals. My role is more or less understanding what employers in the private sector are doing, trends, and why they are doing. I certainly have read about not only at the federal level, but there's been a lot of controversy, let's say, at the state and local levels in terms of their wanting to move more towards a defined contribution approach as they deal with the fiscal crisis. In the private sector, you know, what often happens when we have a recession or we have, you know, financial issues, the regulatory environment around private sector corporate plans is so complex.
Mm-hmm.
The accounting, Arisa. The tax, the actuarial, the funding requirements are so complicated that oftentimes become very onerous. And when you have, you know, interest rates going down and stock market tanking, the way those formulas work, a company, you know, yesterday could be, you know, have a plan that's well funded and the day after have to put millions of dollars of cash into their plan. So at least in the private sector, that's what the issue is the funding. And I believe on the from a state and local funding at a federal level, you're dealing with budgets. You know, coming up with a pay-as-you-go, making sure you meet those future liabilities. And when you have what we've had with the last couple of years in finances, you know, you're either going to raise taxes or raise contributions or look at other ways to cut benefits or make changes. And I believe that's what a lot of that proposal is centering around.
Well, that raises a very interesting point. Dan, tell me if I'm right. I read, in getting ready for this show, I read that the federal employee retirement system is fully funded. That compared to most states which are having problems, which is why they're making cuts to benefits, is because they can't, with what they have, they cannot make their projected payments with their current state of contributions. But I read that the program's fully funded. They actually can afford to make the payments that they are now legally obligated to make.
Right. It is. In fact, the actuaries at the Office of Personnel Management say that retirement annuities will be, because of the status of the fund, will be paid in, or can be paid in perpetuity. I think the problem, though, is that, you know, even though this is a trust fund and it holds U.S. government treasury securities, and that's the other explanation why it doesn't face the same type of risk problems that a lot of state and local government pension funds face, because they're invested in private equities. But the real problem is that because the Civil Service Retirement Disability Fund, while it is a fund and a trust fund that holds treasury securities, it's still part of the unified budget. And so when you look at the big budgetary picture, the ability to fund is also contingent on the government's ability to pay its bills.
Right. They talk about rating it and whatnot.
But well, they are rating it. Isn't that what they're doing, Mike?
That money is not stuck in a vault somewhere. It's commingled with everything else Uncle Sam has, and that's the problem. So it rises and falls with it. Where people criticize it, talk
oh, it's
about
not
it.
Separately set. There's no set aside
it's
like,
set aside,
like a bank
I mean,
account
it's,
with
it's
the, my little number.
It's not in a room somewhere where they keep a lock.
It's
on
an accounting
it.
Ledger.
Yeah, that's right. So it's mingled with everything else. I think the thing that troubles people, and this gets very tricky, when they talk about an unfunded liability. And
that's
and
the state
say,
local problem.
But it's if everybody retired tomorrow, could you pay them off? No, you couldn't in any program I know of. And when you have a baby, when you have a child, you have an unfunded liability immediately of $350,000. That's what it will cost you to raise that child. You know,
minus college education.
Right. But people get their nose out of joint about this, and I think a lot of it. And Dan, I'd be interested to hear what you say, because I think between the two of us, we have about 470 years covering this. Dan is much older than he looks. A lot of this is cyclical. And in the 60s, there was the federal unions, particularly the postal unions, were extremely powerful. They had a post office civil service committee, and they kept going in and they kept getting benefits. Again, primarily the postal unions. They were the shock troops, the Marines. And then it sort of leveled off in the 70s. In the 80s, the Reagan people did not like government, particularly, and the president said, government is the enemy, you know. And then it bounced back a bit, and now you have a different group of people up on the Hill, this group that took over the House last year. And many of them intensely dislike the government, everything it stands for.
Which is ironic, because it's just so ironic to me, because They are part of government.
Well, here's what...
they're like their own branch.
Maybe not.
Maybe not. They're not taking federal pay?
No, no, no. Here's what I'm saying. I keep getting emails from people, and they say, well, why don't congressmen pay what we do? Well, they do. They pay more. They have a better system, but they pay more for it. But here's the rub.
In the past,
everybody who came in said, I'm only going to be here for 2 terms. 70 years later, we dynamite them out or whatnot, but they become part of the system. These new people that have come in, a number of them have said, I'm only here for 1 or 2 terms. And one senator, and I don't want to quote him because I'm not exactly sure of the quote, but he said, if I could get 2 things accomplished, and he named what they were, he said, I would resign. I would leave tomorrow. A number of these senators and congressmen are not signing up for the health benefits program. A number of them are not signing up for the retirement program.
I did hear that.
The only thing worse than having them in is not having them in if you're a federal employee. You want them in as part of the pool and whatnot. And some of these guys are saying, no, I'm not going to be here, and I don't care if it falls apart. In fact, you get the feeling that they hope it does fall apart.
Well, you know, and that's part of the dynamic that they're going to face when it comes to a vote, the whole debt ceiling issue. But that was very interesting what you're saying to me, that there's no set-aside, because when I read how the Treasury Secretary has figured out a way to get us to somewhere in August so we don't have to deal with raising the debt ceiling, it was, I think I read exclusively, they're taking it from the Federal Employee Retirement Fund, that was the maneuver.
But it's an accounting thing, as he said. It's not a lockbox somewhere. Mm-hmm. And this happens every time they have to raise the debt ceiling, and it happens every time there's some kind of problem. They also go after the thrift savings plan, and by law, the law says you must make them whole, you must make up any investments that are lost in any time. So it's a non-issue, but it's a newspaper headline grabber,
okay,
raiding the Civil Service Retirement Fund.
And what I didn't know is that it had been done before, so that actually is very...
Oh, yeah. In fact, probably about 8 times since the mid-'80s it's been done. I mean, we see this movie so often that, you know, that there's, you know, neither party wants to be tagged with raising the debt limit, and so, you know, there's a drawn-out battle on whatever the compromise will be. The problem this time around is that those members of Congress who are intent on making very large cuts to the federal budget are using passage of the debt limit as leverage to get what they want, and obviously that includes, you know, what could be done to federal employees and retirees.
Well, we all saw that play out here in town just to pass the 2011 budget halfway through the budget cycle, so that, you know, the least sophisticated amongst us realize that these are ploys to make it very difficult. I also read that they're going to make it so difficult for some of the congressmen who represent, you know, the districts in and around Washington, D.C. that have large amounts of federal employees choose between a very good budget deal and a provision in there that says, you know, I'm slicing and dicing federal employee benefits, which is extremely difficult if you've watched, which I know, Mike, you have.
Yeah.
For 20 or more years, you've watched, you know, local congressmen and senators have to sort of make that walk.
Well, and in the past, too, you had and the people who are still around, Steny Hoyer and Frank Wolf, Republican Democrat, Maryland, Virginia, and they would take turns. And when a Democrat was in power, Hoyer would run it through and get the pay raises going. When the Republican was in power, Wolf would run that through. But this new element in Congress does make it possibly different.
But yeah, and people, I've heard that. But when you look at the numbers of where it could throw them off on the Republican side for the quote unquote Tea Partiers, the reality is, tell me, you know, maybe I've got this wrong, Mike, but isn't there enough Democrats that they could get into the vote to compensate for losing some of their Tea Partiers who are going to vote against a good deal?
Except they may go along with it too.
But that's exactly. But your point is right on the mark with regard to how the continuing appropriations for fiscal year 2011 was passed in order to avoid a government shutdown. The Republican leadership in the House really depended on a very large portion of the Democratic caucus to vote for that particular deal in order to pass the House. And so that's the reality that the Speaker Boehner is having to deal with, is that he always knows a segment of his Tea Party members are not going to vote with the leadership on some of these budget issues, and that he is depending on a lot of Democrats to vote with him. That's just the reality of what he has to deal with mustering the votes to pass some of this budget and appropriations legislation.
And it it shows you how quickly this can change, too. 2009 was the best year federal, postal, and retirees have ever had on Capitol Hill. Things that just materialized and happened.
Right.
And then 2 years later, this could be easily the worst year they've ever had.
Except, you know, and I shared my thought with Mike before the show, which is just mind-boggling to me. Because 2009, the last quarter of 2009, and all of 2010 was the worst employment. It had the worst that our country faced in the employment sector, the worst it had been in 50 years. The numbers of people getting fired a week, I think, or a month. I think I read at one point it was like 10,000. It had to have been a week, or being furloughed, or taking pay cuts, staying employed, taking pay cuts, and federal employees in 2009 got bonuses and pay raises for 2010. And I wonder what you think about this. I think because the private sector you start to hear is starting, you know, to have decreased unemployment and job growth, I think there's a disconnect that's why federal employees are having such a hard time wrapping their brain around the two-year pay freeze and these cuts is because when you look at the private sector, well, now things are improving. It's sort of like, well, there's a disconnect. They were late to the game.
Yeah, there's always
they were late
a lag
to the table.
And federal workers are faceless bureaucrats nobody pays any attention to when times are good and when times get tough. And look at the states. Look at Montgomery County, front page of the Washington Post today. Major cuts in county employee benefits. Then they become very, you know, they're out there and they're targets.
Well, and that's exactly what happened. You know, with this Cato. The Cato Institute's report on their allegation that feds are overpaid compared to the private sector, their report's been on the shelf since 2006, but back in 2006, it was getting no traction, and the reason why was because the economy was doing well, unemployment was still hovering around 5%. You fast forward to 2008, where unemployment jumps to 10%, and we have a much larger budget deficit and national debt. And all of a sudden, the same report is getting lots of traction because, you know, if you're sitting at home and you're unemployed,
right,
then anybody who's got a job is overpaid.
And you have to pay federal income taxes on your unemployment. And I think there's this enormous disconnect the private sector feels to the federals, to state and you know, to public employees. And then, of course, for public employees, they weathered the storm. And they saw it happening, some of them, in the private sector. And then all of a sudden, the private sector seems to be improving, and now you're coming after our benefits. And I think there's this disconnect that creates this animosity on both sides. But before somebody responds to that, we have to take our mid-show break. You're listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Hey, it's the Geico Gecko. Now, as a federal employee, you're probably one for a smart presentation, so I've put together some charts and graphs here. There you go. That will help illustrate the money you could save by switching to Geico. First thing you'll notice is that Geico now offers discounts to most federal employees GS7 or above. Now, this is big news, but that shouldn't come as any surprise from a car insurance company that has been serving government employees since 1936. And as you can see on this graph here, it's probably why we're the third largest car insurance company in the nation. Yeah, no, I do actually realise you can't see these, but trust me, they're rather impressive, especially the 97% customer satisfaction rate. And when you consider it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more, well, all you GS7 employees or above should just contact Geico. Tell them, Mike.
Hey, folks, this is Mike Causey, and the Gecko said it best. Most federal employees GS7, the equivalent or above, could get a discount on their car insurance. Just call Geico at 1-800-947-AUTO, go to geico.com, or visit your local Geico office to see how much you could save.
I'm Bill Bransford, host of Fed Talk and partner at the law firm of Shaw, Bransford & Roth. Fed Talk brings you inside information on hot topics in the federal community. From the halls of Congress to federal agencies, get the latest on the laws, regulations, and activities that directly impact federal employees. Tune into Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, as we bring in the experts to bring you inside the issues.
Welcome back to Fed Talk. I'm Deborah Roth, and we're in our second part of the show. We spent the first part of our show talking about federal employee retire benefits and some of the arguments for and against making changes. All those changes would have an adverse effect to federal employees. And with me in the studio is Mike Causey. Everybody knows Mike. He's got his own show here on Federal News Radio. Dan Adcox, the legislative director for NARF. And I understand that Lenny Sancola is still with us from World at Work. Lenny, you still there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, thanks, Lenny. Lenny, I'll be interested in your thoughts on this, but I wanted to ask Mike about it because I know he and Dan were talking about it before the show. And it's related to federal retirement benefits. It's federal pay because, as everybody knows, what your pay is, at least for now, 3 years, you know, your high three will, you know, be the basis to calculate your annuity. But Dan and Mike had an interesting conversation going before the show on federal pay and, you know, what's it, you know, and all these comparisons that are made to the private sector. In fact, Dan, you were just talking about the Cato Institute.
Right.
2000, who knew it was a 2006 study that they pulled off the shelf 5 years later? But, you know, Mike, you think it's an unfair conversation. I think that's your point.
You wind up almost inevitably comparing apples and oranges. I mean, it's all, you almost can't help it. The federal government is so different from the private sector in the composition and the kinds of jobs they have and the things they do, the things they're required by law to do. So that's not fair. And I think the most recent one when they came out with the number of federal workers who make over a certain amount of money, 100,000, whatever the figure was.
It was about 150.
Okay, but yeah. the highest number of people were doctors. And I think, hello, I mean, that could be, that's the same in the private sector. So where's the revelation there? And then next it was lawyers, and many of the higher paid people in the feds or people who work for outfits that make their money out of fees, the FDIC, case in point. They get bank fees and whatnot, and they march to a different drum.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I'm not trying to be a cheerleader for federal workers, but when you do start making these comparisons, what's the second largest employer in the U.S. is Walmart. And Uncle Sam is the first?
The first.
Okay.
The first in the world, the largest single employer in the world, is the federal executive branch at somewhere between 1.9 and 2 million people.
Well, you know, you could argue that because in India, half the people work for the government, school teachers. Now, I'm talking about in the U.S., though.
It's clearly Uncle Sam
and Walmart. And they're different. They're very different. Walmart doesn't do NASA. You know, Walmart doesn't go to Antarctica. It's a different mission. So, you know, comparing them, I think, is just silly.
But so if you can't compare, how do you figure out the value of their services?
Well, you had that same thing, that same argument going back when they went to comparable worth. You know, and they were trying to say that secretaries should make as much as accountants, and there were female-dominated and male-dominated occupations. And, you know, you can go all day on that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it is a good backdrop, though. You need to have some foundation for determining people's compensation and value. And some jobs are comparable, but yet not.
Sure.
I think it's an interesting point you make about apples and oranges, because the first thing that comes to mind for me are SEC attorneys, right? So, because, if you're doing security work as a lawyer in the private sector, you're probably making more money than hundreds of people put together, the average American. I mean, that's an incredibly lucrative line of work. And the SEC has their own pay system, and they are making more than the average a government attorney, but they're not making what they could make in the private sector. And yet, in my small brain, before Mike pointed this out to me, I thought, well, it's sort of comparable work. You know, I see your point. It's kind of not, because one's the regulatory enforcer.
Yeah.
And one's the one making commercial transactions.
Right.
And that's kind of different.
One is much more restricted than the other in some of the personal things they can do, too. You know?
Can I just comment on something?
Yeah, you know, Lenny, because I was wondering what you were going to say, because you're a compensation guy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm listening to this conversation, and certainly I agree. You know, there's a lot of unique jobs in the federal government and the various agencies, and so you have to be careful. You'll see different news stories comparing executive level positions and then lower level, and you know, one sector pays more than the other, and that kind of thing. But I see the conversation focused on pay, and you know, in the private sector, we've really been focusing on what we call total rewards, which really is anything that is perceived of value between the employee and the employer. And historically, it was always about pay. You know, what's my hourly wage?
Right. Isn't it always about money?
Well, you know, some will argue that cash is still king, but I think we've learned over the years, at least in the private sector, that, you know, there are other things that are important. And so to me, the first thing you have to do is, you know, you have to benchmark appropriately. If you're in a government agency, you know, what's the skill set that I need, and who am I competing to in the labor market for that skill set? Is it just government, or is it also private sector? If it's both, then you have to say, okay, well, what does the private sector potentially have that we can draw upon? And, you know, telework, workplace flexibility, there are other things other than the pay component, although certainly cash is important, that you can use to benchmark if you are, you know, trying to attract and retain a certain skill set. So, you know, a lot of the controversy, obviously, in the media has been about, you know, pay inequity between the two sectors. But I think we have to move beyond that and start saying, you know, if we're going to have this brain drain at some point and we're going to lose a lot of federal workers, you know, what do we need to do to retain them or attract people to the federal workforce? And is there other things other than pay that people value, such as professional development opportunities, such as recognition, such as workplace flexibility?
Well, you know, I think you make an incredibly valid and interesting point, but I think for most employees, whether they be in the public sector or the private sector, they want it all. And most of what they want is pay. And I think for federal employees, they have such an enormous sense of entitlement to their benefits that they view those as a given. And that they would not, you know, that they're not being taken away from them because, you know, that's part of public services. That's why a lot of people go in, is because it has a very plentiful benefit pool, including now telework and all kinds of family-friendly work rules. And I think the only concern or the problem I see with changing that conversation is changing the culture, because, you know, because cash is still king. Right. So federal employees think they get all those benefits already, and what they're not now getting is pay increases when they look out in the private sector, and the private sector seems to be, you know, warming up.
But again, to your earlier point, the private sector also took, you know, several years of layoffs, several years of pay freezes. Only now are we starting to see, you know, merit increases coming back and bonuses and incentive pay starting to arrive.
Yeah, I agree with you. But I think federal employees, many of them just didn't connect to it. They didn't, they just didn't appreciate that would have an effect on them, because that's why they went into public service, Dan. Isn't that right? In some part, they went in because it is their safety there and job security. And people make that compromise in their career sometimes because they're looking for that security.
Right. Well, I think for a lot of occupations in the federal government, they're going to be paid less than the equivalent in the private sector. And so it's a trade-off of there's trade-offs, and and they know that the federal government has health insurance that will take them into retirement, and they also know that they have the benefit of a supplemental annuities in the FERS program, and also the what they get through the thrift savings plan, the government's version of the 401k. So that goes into the equation of making those types of decisions.
Yeah, see, so Lenny, that's sort of like I hear what you're saying, but I think when you look at the reality of 1.9 million people, you know, some filtering in and out or moving in and out within the government. The unions and associations that represent them, I think, have this mentality as well. They view all of those benefits to be like a given, non-negotiable. Okay. And so for them, because they've made some of these compromises that Dan was talking about, mostly pay, when you start cutting their pay and making them pay more of their own pay into their retirement system,
And you mentioned earlier about culture and entitlement philosophy, and again, even in the private sector, again, if we go back to and define benefit plans or primary, and we had a lot of retiree medical programs, and you know, you go back 30 or 40 years, that paternalistic entitlement culture was there as well in the private sector, but obviously has evolved to more of a shared accountability and you know, and again, that's not something you change overnight, culture. And I think Mike was saying about trade-offs, and you're absolutely right. You know, there's trade-offs. you know, whatever, however you look at it.
Right, right. No, and I agree with you. I think, Lenny, it's going to take time. And I think for people right now, Dan, I wonder if you agree with me, people in the system right now, in the federal employment system, this is their time. And I think, you know, they're going to feel something. Something's going to come out of this budget cycle, and it's going to be the beginning of maybe a larger transition into what the private sector's benefits and not pay,
right,
but benefits look like.
Well, I mean, I think this is all a function of that. You know, these decisions made, unfortunately, because federal workers work for the federal government and the Congress controls what those benefits are going to be. Unfortunately, politics is interjected into these decision-making processes. Instead of these decisions being based on, you know, these compensations being based on, well, what do we need to do to attract the best and brightest to the federal government? But sort of getting back to this idea of entitlement, you know, I don't know that I necessarily find that. You know, right now our organization is having its state federation conventions. We have them. Most of our state federations have their conventions in April and May, and I've been to many of them in the last few weeks. And what I'm finding is that at least speaking for our organization, that our members are willing to make sacrifices. But what's troubling to them is if they have to make sacrifices that are disproportionate to other constituencies that are served by the federal government. And the reality is that, you know, we saw during the town hall meetings that were held during the Easter and Passover recess, that on one hand, there are some constituents that were very upset with their members of Congress for voting for the deal to avoid the government shutdown because it didn't go far enough. But the flip side of it, and which was very schizophrenic about the reaction, is that they are also dead. A lot of the same people were dead set against the Medicare proposal that was in the House budget resolution because it would privatize Medicare and then index the government share of what they pay for the Medicare Part B premium using the consumer price index, which essentially would shift a tremendous amount of costs away from the government and towards Medicare beneficiaries. So the point being is that in the abstract, there's a lot of Americans out there that want huge cuts of the federal budget. But in the concrete, when they're talking about a program that either they want to be in the future or right, in the current right now, they have a problem with that. And the problem that we've had historically is that these large popular programs with big constituencies are taken off the table, and the only thing that's left is federal retirement and health benefits and pay. And so our community takes a disproportionate hit because we're much smaller, 4.6 million versus 40 million in Medicare, 40 million in Social Security.
You know, we're going to have to take our final break in a second, but I did read a great quote from someone at NTEU, very large federal employee union, that said, "We don't mind, you know, taking our hit here, but don't come back for seconds from me,
right,
unless you go and get first from someone else." And I frankly have said that before on my own situation. It's like, I'm paying my federal income taxes. It's mind-boggling to me that some of the largest corporations in America, mostly oil and gas companies, don't pay a dime in federal income taxes and get subsidies. I can't process that. It doesn't make any sense to me that I would pay thousands and thousands of dollars in income taxes and they pay none. And they, of course, have a lot more money than me. So I thought that NTEU quote was really great.
Mm-hmm.
And it might be, Dan, a shift in the culture of the federal or perception of the federal mind. But we, as I said, we're going to take our final break, and we are going to speak in final depth with Dan when we get back about what what do we project to be the cuts to federal retirement benefits that are going to come out of the deal that has to get made by August. You're listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
It's the Geico Gecko with a little hello to all you federal employees. Now, in government, there are people on all points of the political spectrum, but there is one thing that everyone agrees on. Saving money is good, which brings me to the big news. Geico now offers discounts to most federal employees GS7 or above. It doesn't matter if you're a Democrat or an aristocrat, left wing, right wing, or a chicken wing. If you're a federal employee, GS7 or above, you could be saving a lot of money on your car insurance by switching to Geico. So no matter if you're blue or red, or in my case, green. If you're a federal employee, GS7 or above, contact Geico and see how much you could save. Isn't that right, Mike?
Exactly right, my little green friend. Hey, folks, this is Mike Causey. And like the Gecko said, discounts are available for most federal employees, GS-7, the equivalent, or above. Just call GEICO at 1-800-947-AUTO, go to geico.com, or visit your local GEICO office to see how much you could save.
Welcome back to Fed Talk. I'm Deborah Roth. And this was a show we produced on federal retirement benefits, where we're headed, you know, some sort of sense of projecting what's going to come out of the latest budget deal. And I really think that if you're looking for someone with an insight vision of what the possibilities are, we're very fortunate to have with us Dan Adcock, who's the legislative director for NARF, and because no one's watching that closer than NARF. So, Dan, you know, we have about 10 minutes or 7 minutes left, actually, to our show. And, you know, they're talking about several changes, high three to high five, larger contributions, I think delaying COLAs. Tell our listeners what you think we can see. What are the range of possibilities?
Well, it's huge. And I think that, you know, we're in the midst of a budget challenge to the earned retirement and health benefits and pay of federal employees, retirees, that we haven't seen in a generation. You know, just for starters, the Laurie Montgomery, reporter in The Washington Post, had an article last Sunday in the very front page lead article that the administration seemed to be embracing the proposal that was made in the House budget resolution, also made by the Fiscal Commission, to require at least FERS employees to contribute 5% more towards their retirement. So essentially they'd be paying more for the same benefit, but it's even worse than that. They'd be paying more for a reduced benefit, but because of the two-year pay freeze that federal workers are also enduring, that affects the size of their annuity. So they'd be paying more for less. And we really view this as a tax. And what's ironic about that is, on one hand, there are some lawmakers that are saying that taxes should be taken off the table, they shouldn't be part of the equation, but they don't seem to have any objection to imposing a 5% middle-class tax on federal workers.
Well, it's an easy constituency to hit, as Mike was saying. You know, there's a silent constituency, and even though they're represented by associations and unions, it's just not enough to change an election.
Right.
Only in, you know, the districts that surround, you know, the D.C., the seat of the government, and the majority of congressmen and senators they don't have enough federal employee constituents to really care. So it's an easy target.
It is. And the other thing is that, you know, the federal community has been the victims of saturating bombing, you know, for the last several months with the Cato Institute report and Heritage and work that the American Enterprise Institute
so do you think,
has done.
Dan, do you yeah. think there's going to – do you think that one of the inevitabilities that's going to come out of this budget deal – or it's a deal to raise the debt ceiling. Mm-hmm. Do you think one of the inevitabilities is that federal employees are going to have to pay more in their contributions into the system?
I don't know that it's inevitable, but, you know, the problem is that when the administration starts sending up a trial balloon that this is something they're interested in, then it could take the same form that the two-year pay freeze, because, you know, all last year we were fighting basically the same legislation. There was four separate attempts in the House and the Senate last year to do exactly that, to have a two-year pay freeze. And the federal community and then our friends, especially in the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area congressional delegation, mm-hmm. we were all able to beat those back successfully. And it wasn't until the president looked at all 45 proposals that were made by the Fiscal Commission, and the only one he embraced was this two-year pay freeze. So when that happened, it basically all bets were off and we lost it. Mm-hmm. So that's why I think that a lot of us are very concerned about what will happen.
The trial balloon.
That's right.
Yeah.
Right.
So currently, Fed's their contribution into the system is what percent?
Well, for the federal employee retirement system, it's 0.8% of salary. And, you know, when FERS was first created during the mid-80s, you have to go back and look at the civil service retirement system contribution, which was 7%. And so what happened is that 6.2% of that 7% was instead for FERS employees diverted to Social Security. And so essentially, FERS employees are paying the same proportion out of their paycheck for their retirement. The difference is it's now split much more heavily towards Social Security versus the FERS system.
There's never an explanation for why it's so low, the contribution.
But that's it. That's the explanation why it's so low. But the other important thing is that when you look at for those employers that still do have defined benefit annuities, rarely do they require their employees to make any kind of contribution towards their defined benefit annuity.
Lenny, do you agree with that?
That is correct. In the private sector, it's very rare for employees to contribute to a defined benefit program.
Right. Wow. So federal employees are currently required to contribute 0.8, and they'll be going to
5.8% total of contribution. And again, a huge increase out of their paychecks for...
Is that tax deferred? Is that a...
No, that's after tax. Yeah. Those contributions are with after-tax dollars. And here's the real rub about this.
So it's no set-off against your...
No, it's not. No, not that this, because this is not like the thrift savings plan or a 401k, because it's going into this defined benefit annuity. Here's the real rub, though, is on this particular proposal that's going to be really damaging is that if you're on the medium to low end of the federal employee pay scale and you're already having a very difficult time contributing a sufficient percentage of your paycheck to your thrift savings plan, you're going to have even less income for that purpose.
They're going to not defer to their TSP.
That's right. So it's going to mean that there's going to be more federal workers who are lower paid, who are going to be leaving the workforce when they retire
without their TSP,
having saved enough money for their TSP. So when you add all these things together, when you add the increase in employee contribution, the Social Security payroll tax, and a 5% contribution to TSP, we're over 17% contribution for these FERS employees going towards their retirement.
And that's an issue actually in the private sector since 401k and defined contribution approaches have become more prevalent. There's a lot of concern now both at the congressional level as well as conversation about retirement adequacy. Will people have with longevity and people living 20 and 30 years in their retirement, will there be enough money for people to survive?
Yeah, and with the Great Recession that we all experienced a year or so ago, many people in my age group around the 50 mark, we just said, it took us a few months, but we're like, we're just going to be working forever because our 401ks became our 201ks, and you sort of have to make a mental adjustment about where that puts you in life. And so I think people, I think the idea of retiring at 55, even to people today who are CSRS eligible, if there's something, it's something a little bit out of date about that. They're going to still work. They'll take their benefit, their retirement benefit, and then go get a job in the private sector. So I think, as Lenny, the point you're making is I just think people are just going to work for a whole lot longer than you've ever seen people working in, our civil society. And that could just be a factor of good health and interest in, in contributing.
And paying college tuition.
Right. And of course, the inability to financially be able to retire. And if there's any cuts to Social Security, then you've just eliminated really a large possibility that large sectors of the workforce could afford to retire.
Mm-hmm. And that's what's interesting when we talk about the brain drain that was mentioned earlier, and that's been talked about for the past decade.
Right.
I don't know
if we'll
see that, because a lot of people are not financially prepared to retire, or as you said earlier, maybe they'll leave the career that they have, but they're going to go work somewhere else because they're going to need supplemental income in order to have a quality standard of living during their retirement years.
Yeah, as Dan points out, retirement at 55, many of those people have kids in college, and college tuition has so grotesquely outpaced cost of living. You need full-time employment just to pay that. We are in the last 30 seconds of the show. I want Dan's view on high three to high five. You think we're headed there?
I think that's a possibility, and that's certainly, I think that definitely, of all the proposals, would contribute to the brain drain, because people will retire in order to avoid that change in the law that would significantly reduce their annuity. And just very lastly, we're very concerned about a proposal that would limit the government's share for the federal employee health benefits program, and over time, over by 2020, we project that you would go from paying on about 30% of premium to 58% of the premium. That's the one that really keeps us up at night.
Yeah. Anyway, listen, we're going to have everybody back to figure this all out as it unfolds. But thank you so much, Dan Adcock, Lenny Santacola from World at Work. Thanks for joining us.